Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
What's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you? State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the Morning right now on WICC 600.
We have a pretty big day ahead of us in Hartford. A lot of public hearings happening today, so let's get right into it. Before we do, though, Senator Tony Wong, I wanted to bring something to the forefront because I know that you obviously are knee-deep in what's going on with our health insurance. And, you know, learning about the ACA subsidy qualification changes from the American Rescue Plan, as well as two possible new carriers coming to the Connecticut marketplace. Governor Lamont had said he doesn't see why the public health option bill should be rushed to a vote. Do you have faith in what he's saying? Do you believe it is still being pushed through? And if so, why even bother, I think, pushing this at this point?
Good morning, Melissa, and beware the Ides of March, right? Hey, the goal is to lower cost burden of health insurance premiums on consumers. And I agree with the governor on why are we rushing to a vote like we did last week in a committee. But unfortunately, Controller Limbo and the Democratic legislative leaders are frantically still pushing to pass this suspect bill of the public option. And I believe it is not about public policy, but a political agenda.
So this is a power move.
It's a silo perspective reflecting, in my opinion, what I said repeatedly, and you'll hear that this morning, is the arrogance of one-party rule and control. They know what is best, and that regardless of other ideas and shareholders' impact and trying to get together and working, no, we know the best way. It's sort of like, you know, you get people that say, I know what's best for everybody. And we're going to implement it, and you wait and see. That is not good governance. That is not a collaborative effort. So it does reflect that. And I do agree with the governor, is we got a fast-changing landscape. Why are we rushing to a vote? And you know, it's not just public option health insurance, right? It's so many other things. Mm-hmm. We saw that policy and approach in the police bill
Yes.
that we're still trying to unwind from. It really is kind of a frustration. And if I can sum it up, it really is the idea of this session. The theme for me is the state-mandated takeover of certain aspects of how we govern, how we live, and how we interact versus home rule, versus local input and control. It's saying that the state knows best. And unfortunately for many people, it really hasn't been the way.
Well, I'm hoping that they don't know best with this mansion tax, because if you were listening to the show earlier, Senator, Governor Lamont came right out and said, I don't support this idea. He does not support the idea of a mansion tax for anyone's home or business, commercial business building, being $300,000 or more. That's just ludicrous to me that we would even consider having an extra tax on top of our property taxes and even think that that's considered to be a mansion. What can you tell us more about this? I know there's a public hearing on it today.
Well, Melissa, first and foremost, what a coup to have the governor to be on the show to share these insights. You know, I stand a pale second to the governor in your news catch on this, but I agree. First, the idea of a mansion tax is an insult to hardworking middle class Connecticut residents.
I agree.
That save their money and do all the right things. And then to say, oh, you know what? The state knows better now to impose a statewide property tax on you in addition to the property taxes that you pay to meet your community services that you will receive. So to me, it is. $300,000 is far too low. But that the fact is, though, why are we imposing a statewide property tax to redistribute income? It goes back to what I said. I sound like a broken record. It's state takeover and mandates versus home rule and local control. It says the state knows what's better than you on the neighborhood, on your local governance, the people that you know that run your towns. I disagree with that vehemently. There is a standard in the state of Connecticut that home rule, respecting the uniqueness of each town, is fundamental to the founding of this country, actually.
Mm-hmm. Talking to State Senator Tony Huang this morning, and, you know, you talk about neighborhoods, things like that. This actually segues perfectly into another public hearing, which my understanding from you, Senator, is that you've got hundreds of people signed up to give public testimony. You've got hundreds that were written in. But planning and zoning, supporters say this is going to help grow our cities and diversify our towns. What are the problems, though, that you're seeing with this bill?
I sound like a record again. It's state-mandated control over local rule and control. Here's the deal. The committee cognizance of planning and zoning is the interaction between state governance and municipal governance. We're going to propose bills this today that says that zoning rules, affordable housing, and land use policies that are purview of planning and zoning, watershed protection areas, as well as conservation, and the state is going to tell you what to do. One egregious example is if you live near a train station, if the Milford Green, which is beautiful right mm-hmm. next to the train station, or Old Saybrook, which is a quaint a little village, or even Southport Small Train Station, this law proposed would say within a half-mile radius, anybody can go in and build multiple four-unit housing without any input or control from the local governance. It's just going to happen. Builders are salivating, ready to do that. The other part of it is they're going to change the word character, which shows wonderful communities like the Town Green in Milford. They say that doesn't count. If I want to build a high-density housing, five-story apartment, because part of it is affordable housing, I can do it because character is not a determinant in regards to.
But what would be a middle ground then? Because we have, I think both sides have to agree that we don't have enough affordable housing. It's stupid expensive to live here, to put it bluntly. So we have to find some way to find more affordable housing that's not just an inner city. But at the same time, you're right. How do we also preserve places like the Milford Green from being overhauled and used for properties?
Melissa, great question. Towns are under tremendous pressure through A30G to initiate these plans already. There is, perhaps maybe historically, there was some exclusion and bias, but they can't do it now. And so you see a lot of towns taking the initiative to create diverse housing. And the fact is, they should be collaborating with the state, with the neighborhood, and with our federal government to create solutions. And that these kind of opportunities should be a collaborative one, not a top-down. I agree. There is a tremendous need for diverse, affordable, and accessible housing everywhere in our state. But none of these proposals, Melissa, affords a opportunity for the cities, for our rural area, for our suburbs. All of these proposals increases supply, increases density. And it changes environmental impact considerations of density with sewer and septic capacity increases. It's a real concern in regards to environmental protection that we're not addressing here. But the solution has to be collaboration between neighborhoods, local, state, and federal to make it all work. But it also has to incorporate finding solutions for our urban communities that have been ripped away by regentrification. Our rural areas that would love to have more capacity right. to be able to accommodate people and a quality of life, and also our suburbs where land costs can be so high. It has to be all aspects. And I'm going to tell you this. This is a frustration. These bills that are being proposed today, I have had no input on them. Again, seems to be a common theme, right? Public option, no input from Republicans. Planning and zoning, no input other than today, where we're going to have a public hearing, where we saw the bills, our people have going to have input. I had no input, no sitting down in the conversation. And why is that? Why is it going back to the public option?
Right. It's a big question of concern for sure. And I think it's something that I continue to try to press to the other side. And I'll keep doing that because you're right. I think it's something that is certainly a huge concern, especially with one party rules. So I appreciate you bringing it to the forefront. Unfortunately, Senator Wong, we have run out of time, but thank you so much again. And we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities on WICC 600.
And today we get to talk to the legislative liaison, Darcy Jones Strand, and we're talking about a disparity study for the state of Connecticut. Darcy, thanks for coming to the show. What can you tell us about this study?
Hi. So this is one of the CHRO's main legislative priorities this session. We have a bill currently in front of the Labor Committee that would have the CHRO work with other state agencies to conduct a study. We think this is a really important part of achieving racial equity in the area of economic opportunity for minority-owned businesses, and it's a really crucial part of helping bring the state out of the the economic downturn that's come as part of the being hit by the pandemic so hard. What it plays into is the state set-aside program. And what the state set-aside program is a program that was set up to make sure that small businesses and minority-owned businesses have a fair shot at getting state contracts. So the way it works is under current state laws, 25% of state contract dollars are set aside for small businesses. An additional 25% of that 25%, just to make it confusing with numbers, is set aside for minority-owned businesses. So what that means is it's been tried in the past to make sure that small businesses and minority-owned businesses have really a fair shot at state contracting dollars, which, is obviously a huge pile of money. There's always roads to be paved, schools to be constructed. So what a disparity study would do is make sure that the state set-aside program is actually working the way it's supposed to. So it would gather data about, what discrimination may still exist in access to state contracting, and also see whether or not those 25% numbers I mentioned are still at the levels they should be, like whether or not we should maybe be putting more money aside for these minority-owned businesses.
So what I love about having the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, what I love about having the Commission on every week is that I want to be vulnerable and understand better maybe things that I didn't see being sheltered and growing up in Fairfield County to a white family. Maybe there are things I don't know. But it never really made sense to me, Darcy, if I'm being honest. Like, are you saying that minority-owned businesses are actually discriminated against? Like, so for example, I know this is a crazy example, but let's just say you're a town, you've got 100 businesses there. Are you saying that like businesses that are owned by minority or by women, for example, like that they'd be like last on the list to get money a lot of times? Like that's happening very often in Connecticut? Because to me, it's like a business is a business. If I have 100 businesses, I'm going to give money to all of them.
Yeah, well, first off, I appreciate your willingness to talk about these things. I actually grew up in Idaho, so I understand kind of a newness to a lot of these issues.
Yeah.
I also grew up in, an area where I didn't deal with a lot of this, so I appreciate that. So I think a lot of it isn't necessarily the, kind of overt refusal to deal with, to give business to minority-owned businesses or women-owned businesses. What it more is kind of a historical lack of, maybe the contacts minority-owned businesses may have needed to get these contracts now.
So, like, maybe they don't, they're not aware of how to, apply for these loans or things like that?
Yeah, a lot of it is just kind of, over time, I think we all know, 50 years ago, there wasn't the state contracting dollars there for minority-owned businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these businesses haven't had the time, over the past decades to build up the capital or to build up the relationships they needed to or the networks they needed to in order to get these contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And there also is, a lack of understanding, I think, for a lot of newer businesses on how to get these state contracting dollars. A lot of it is relationships, Do you know whether or not to apply for the bids when the bids go out? Do you know all the, it's state bureaucracy, right? So you have to know all the paperwork that you have to file. You have to know who to talk to in order to get the bidding started. It's a long process. And I think a lot of the minority-owned businesses just haven't had the chance, historically speaking, to get a lot of that process started, to be on the list that you need to be on. So a lot of this set-aside program is to try to kind of correct the historical injustices that have occurred To make sure that minority-owned businesses get that fair shot.
Well, I appreciate that breakdown because, like I said, I'm pretty outspoken on my show about the fact that I think it's crazy that, you know, even the Crown Act. I'm thrilled that the Crown Act passed in Connecticut, but like to me, it's insane that we have to put legislation out there that says, hey, you probably shouldn't discriminate against somebody because of the like how their hair is worn. That's crazy to me. Like, how are we not already doing that? That's wild to me. I'm glad, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's crazy to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, we're so excited that we got that bill done, and it's great it got done so early in session, which, you know, things can run out of time in session.
Sure.
So we're thrilled that got done so early, but I agree. It's crazy that that's the kind of thing that we still need to do. But, you know, working at the commission, we see these kinds of cases all the time. And, you know, like I said, under the set aside program right now, the number is at 6.25% of money that's set aside for minority-owned businesses. And our thought is that probably when we do the disparity study, we're probably going to find that the term of art for this is like underutilization. Like, how many minority-owned businesses are out there that would want state contracts if they were able to get them?
Mm.
And we think the number's probably way higher than that. Like, we think once we conduct the study, we think it's actually going to be higher than that. So, you know, we think that if we're actually able to get this disparity study done, we're going to find there's a lot more small, like, minority-owned businesses out there than we think that are, like, not able to get these dollars that would like to be able to do this work.
Well, you know,
the state's missing an opportunity to like keep the state money in the state with local small businesses that want to do this work.
Well, and you said before, Darcy, you know, like when I was asking why this is happening, you know, the idea of like historically building up contacts or knowing exactly, you know, how to apply for these loans, for example. What about on the other side of things? You know, like maybe not falling on just the businesses, but what as a state, you know, what could our leaders do better to make sure that these minority-owned businesses are actually being compensated?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, the Commission on Human Rights, for our part, we do try to do a lot of outreach and a lot of training with our contract compliance unit. We've tried to do a lot of outreach to try to make sure small businesses understand how to comply with the affirmative action plans and everything they have to do with our side of the agency. But you're right, like when it comes to the actual, you know, registering with the state, you know, all the things that they need to do in order to be considered for the state contracting dollars, which tends to happen with the Department of Administrative Services and other state agencies, I think it's something that the state has some work to do on, although DAS has obviously done a great job and has, you know, done a lot of improvements over the last few years. But one of the things that's in actually the bill that we're trying to pass this year does have a component of like really taking a hard look at what the state can do to make access easier for these businesses. So one of the components of the bill as it's written now is taking a look at these things to make sure that the state does what it needs to do to make sure access is easier.
Legislative liaison Darcy Jones Strand, we appreciate you coming on and sharing this with us this morning. Thank you so much, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
Yes, of course.
Lieutenant Jim Perez, Fairfield Police Department. Crime on the mind. Melissa in the morning. WICC 600.
Okay, then take care of the matter. If we don't hear from you, then legal action will be taken against you. Before you get apprehended and taken into custody for legal actions and to avoid legal consequences, you may press 9 now to get connected to our paralegal team.
Let's talk about sketchy phone calls, because scam calls are a huge, huge problem. Are they not, Lieutenant Perez? I mean, good God.
Yes, they are. And as a matter of fact, in this day in 2021, it's not a matter of if you're going to get your information compromised. It's here already. Everyone's information is compromised to a certain extent. And, you know, you can thank lax security measures by major corporations, including credit bureaus, who have had the uncanny ability of being able to give out all our information unnecessary. I mean, not on purpose, but, you know, they just kind of, these are breaches that people are taking place with technology. It's becoming a lot more easier for people to appear legitimate when they're actually not.
Yeah. So, I mean,
that is for sure.
What are you seeing, at least out of your department? What are some of the most common phone scams that you guys are coming across?
Well, there's two different ones that recently have been hitting one. One is one that's initiated by the victim, actually, when they join a group or a social media website, such as firstmet.com. There was this one woman who actually met someone there. And the guy, you know, they listen, these scammers, they're excellent, and they're very sophisticated at using highly effective psychological tactics. And I've talked about this in the past, some of the tactics that they use. But they're able to kind of grind a person down to the point where they're giving away money. This person gave away, I think it was like the total amount was $44,000.
What?
But it was over a period of time, of a 2 or 3 week period.
Well, giving money for what, though? What was she giving money away for?
Well, you know, met this person online. The person starts saying that he's doing some drilling in Canada and that he's going to make $12 million out of it. And then he says that he's going to eventually buy cars for all of her children, this and that. You know, it's kind of like a forged relationship.
Wow.
A bad one, actually. And then he says that, you know, there's problems with the pipes and money has to be sent over. So she was sending money over a little bit at a time, $1,400 here, $4,000 there, $5,000 there.
And I to mean, a guy that she's not even really dating.
Exactly, that she doesn't even really know.
Jeez.
And this is why it's important. I tell this to people all the time. You have to watch out for your parents. You have to keep an eye on them. You have to kind of constantly quiz them and ask them questions about who's in their lives. Because oftentimes we have our own private lives with our own issues with children and everything else. And then, you know, you kind of forget that they're sort of there. Mm-hmm. And then those scammers are counting on those very individuals to be lonely so they can take advantage of them. Mm-hmm. Another different type of scam that we have. And you know what? I know I'm running through these. I would love to have tons of time because I think the best lesson that people could learn is by having the actual victims on air talking about how they became a victim. Because mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to learn from those conversations. But anyway, we have another one from someone who said that her husband was withdrawing money and sending it to scammers. This individual was told that he won the Publisher's Clearinghouse thing. You know, the
right, that massive contest. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. And saying that he won $5,000 a month for life, but he had to go to the bank and pay taxes and fees and all these things to the tune of $30,000. The sad thing is that this older guy went to the bank, got a cashier's check, and the bank didn't even question him about it.
That's so crazy to me, because that's the thing, is we need to be proactive, but, like, are there people looking out for us, though? That's crazy.
No, this is the thing. Listen, here's the bottom line. And this is why we're behind the times. The scammers are always ahead of the game. They're mm-hmm. always ahead of government. They're always ahead of the community. They're always ahead of everybody. There's this thing that goes on right now. If you or I were to either take or withdraw, not $9,999, but $10,000 from the bank, right, that triggers what's called a SARS report, so a suspicious activity report. Mm-hmm. It's something that the federal government wants to keep tabs on so that they can try to, go after terrorists, money launderers, things like that.
Sure.
Here's the problem. We need a law right here in Connecticut. Everybody wants to attack the police. They want to do this. They want to do that. Well, here's the police giving the state an opportunity to do something right, okay? We need a specific law that will deal with every institution that if someone comes in and tries to withdraw a certain amount of money, there are stopgaps and cooperations or different checks that will be made before that money gets released. And that's going to include contacting a relative or someone else, even though it's your money. I don't care.
Because this is run rampant. This is run rampant,
yeah.
Though. That's the thing. You're right. It's very archaic that we don't believe, like, oh, we got to be ready for it. Like, it's here. It is already here. And as much as we've seen big corporations and we've seen the federal government try to stop this, it's here. So what do you do now with it? What do you do with it?
As police, we deal right now. We are so visual, right? So right now we deal with overt crimes, and mm-hmm. those are crimes that happen, right? We're witnesses to it. Oh, my God, that person just got hit.
Right.
Call the police. Oh, my God, they just robbed products from a store. Call the police. What we don't deal with very well are the hidden crimes that are taking place, which are insidious and actually sometimes are worse than the actual overt crimes that we see. So while we're trying to so picture this. Picture you're trying to save money, right? But you have one person in the house who constantly in the winter leaves one window wide open and the heat is on and the heat just keeps going out. What you're seeing besides seeing actual physical heat, you know, in the form of waves going out the window, you can transfer that into money because that's what's actually going out the window is money. We're being wasteful. It's the same thing here. Here we have a major issue where we're fighting over crimes and you want us to do that, but there's the hidden crimes that are taking place that nobody wants to talk about and nobody wants to address
that's actually affecting and costing more money than the overt crimes. And that's what we're dealing with. So we have, so as a result, we have residents that right now are losing $30,000, $40,000, $5,000 here and there. And that's awful.
Yeah.
That's just awful.
Well, in
my
understanding,
what do we need to do?
I was going to say, my understanding, Lieutenant Perez, is I don't know every single bank. I can't speak for every single bank, but I do know, like, the bank that I belong to in Fairfield. I know of some other ones that I have friends who work for them. Like, there are trainings that are in place for tellers and bank personnel so that they can help identify these situations. But I know it's not as clear cut as maybe the examples we're giving. So I do know that that some banks are doing it. I don't know if all are. And certainly that is something to look into is, you know, even with trainings, is there more that could be done. But yeah, I just think if there's a more proactive approach and even, you know, just us being more educated on scams and what they look like. For example, I know I've told this story before and my parents know I've shared it, but like my mom and dad last year were trying to adopt cats and they went online and it looked like a reputable guy who was selling cats and they took out, you know, those gift cards or whatever and they ended up losing about $900. And I said to my parents, I was like, this is a scam. This is a scam. I could see it. It's a scam. And it got to a point where finally they were like, listen, this doesn't seem legitimate. And the guy never responded back. And they had already lost that money. So it's like, even when we educate ourselves enough on it, I don't know if everybody catches it quick enough. Or it seems like it's not going to be me, but it is going to be you.
Listen, I'm going to end by giving you this horrific story. And it's kind of horrific, not in a physical sense where the person got injured, but horrific in what they are actually doing now, these scammers. These scammers, I said before, are experts in using psychological tactics. So they use such things as source credibility. They try to build the credibility by claiming they're somebody that they're not. They try to use social consensus, which is a psychological scam, which means that everybody's doing it. This is what you need to do. And most importantly, they do what's called reciprocity or phantom riches. They dangle all these things saying you're going to make money, which one of our victims went through that. And the other one went through reciprocity, where I'm going to do you a favor. Well, listen to this one. Just yesterday we had a call where a woman called to complain that, and this is how it took place. Someone called her cell phone from her house phone. Picture that one. Now these are all
that just seems like that movie, like where it's like who's checking the children. That just seems like a very
she actually thought someone was in her house. But picture this.
Jeez.
So they called, and this is all part of the trick. They called from the house phone to the cell phone. They kept calling. She kept ignoring it, knowing that she was the only one in the house. She ignored it.
Right.
After a half a day, she finally picked it up, and it was someone from Apple saying that your systems have been breached, and you probably see that, you know, there's things going on in your house right now. And of course, it was a phone call from the home phone to the cell phone.
Right, right.
Because remember, the scammers have all this information. So they told her the fastest way, we can clear it up by you sending us a check or whatever. She goes, because they were trying to tell her that her whole system is messed up.
Right.
And her Apple ID needs to be redone and all this stuff. So they told her, but the fastest way is to go get gift cards. So this woman went out and purchased $9,000 worth of gift cards.
Wow.
While she was doing that, she was giving them the numbers on the back, because once you reveal those numbers on the back, this is an electronic world. It's instantly gone. The money's gone. There's nothing you can do about it. So she did that, right? Then she came back and it started again, the phone calls from the homes to the cell, home to the cell. And she realized that it was a scam. She called the police. Listen to this one. The police get there. One of our officers get there. He starts taking all the information. And as he's taking the information, the phone is ringing relentlessly. It just kept ringing. She refuses to answer it. So now she hears an alarm. And the officer hears this too. And the officer's like, what's going on? Do you have a fire alarm or something? She goes, no. They walk over to her computer. Now they're trying to get a hold of her through her computer. They took over her computer and attempted to get over. And then guess what? Her camera on the computer goes on, and now the scammer is watching the cop and the victim.
I don't like
standing
this.
There.
This is freaky.
Standing there. And then guess what? Guess what? They hung up when they saw the cop.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently there was a malware that was put into her computer. They took over her computer.
Sure.
While they were, it gets even more insidious. While they're talking to her, trying to convince her that it's Apple.
Right.
They said to her, hey, look. And they brought up her bank accounts. They brought them all up.
That's so
creepy.
And the
guy goes, watch this. Once you give us the money, this is what we can do. And he erased all the accounts in front of her, right in her computer. This is how things are happening. Now, you're talking about $9,000 from one person, $30,000 from another person. Listen, that money can be better spent, right?
Well, yeah, of course.
So, and then we wonder why citizens can't pay their taxes, why they can't pay this, why they can't pay that. There is a hidden crime that's being taken place. It's bubbling under the surface, and all of our community members are being ripped off to the point where they're getting into financial problems.
Yeah.
We need to stop this.
Yeah, we do. I was going to say, unfortunately, Lieutenant, you're making such great points. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but you're so right, and I think we should continue talking about this, hopefully, when you come back on next week. Thank you so much.
Sure, you're very welcome. Have a great week.
All right, thanks, you too. All right, so 2 weeks ago, we talked about why do some marriages do well and flourish while others struggle. We did part one, talking about ways that you can help your marriages to grow in the right direction by showing interest in what your spouse is interested in, showing you care, showing appreciation, and being accepting, knowing you are not perfect, and neither is your spouse. Today, we kick off part two with my very good friend and our marriage consultant, Bob Donovan. So, Bob, let's get it cracking right now. What is the part two? What's number one? What's a way that we could flourish our marriages?
Yep. All right. Good to hear from you again. So the first thing I'd say is to be intentional about connecting with each other. This really hit me between the eyes when I was talking to a couple recently, and they were married 18 years. And they're asking my wife and I, how do you keep your marriage fresh? And we were married 45 years. And we said, yes, we have to work at it. You have to work at connecting. You have to work at having a conversation. You have to work at doing things together.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, they looked at me and said, what? You mean you have to work at this? It doesn't come natural.
I love it.
And they really looked at it. They said, it doesn't come natural by just being together. And I said, on the contrary, the longer you're married, the higher risk it is not to do this. Because you fall into this cruise control mentality.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you think. They think that it just is normal that you will feel connected by being together.
Mm.
And it's furthest from the truth. So that's number one, is you really have to work at this. Karen and I really work at this. Even it's simple things, just planning on going for walks. Date nights is an obvious one. Something we did yesterday, we've been in a lot at night. So we sat down and we picked out a couple shows that we want to watch together. So,
mm-hmm.
It just shows intention about connecting.
Yeah. And I love that idea of getting out of your routine or your comfort zone, especially if you've had children. I have to imagine that it's a little bit even harder to be intentional with your spouse.
Yeah. That's a whole other topic.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
Oh, man, staying married with a toddler or two toddlers is really, really hard. I mean, you really have to then manage your expectations. Where you guys are right now.
Yeah.
Going out probably once a month is heaven.
Oh, it's awesome. Oh, it's great. It's awesome. It's called Mom and Dad. Yeah. They are great. Love that. Love grandparent life. What up, Mom and Dad? Love that. So, they let us go out to dinner once a month. It's great.
We had three of them inside of 4 years, and we went out for pizza once a month.
Wow.
And that kept Karen sane, just that pizza night.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Exactly. That's, I can only imagine.
Yeah. The second one is similar. It's almost like a subset. It's basically share your heart with each other.
Mm.
And what's interesting about this is that with a couple, there's usually an oversharer and an undersharer. Melissa, does that ring true? I don't know if you know anybody like that. Maybe.
I am the biggest oversharer. And Derek, it's just peeling back an onion. He's gotten a lot better, though. I will say he's gotten a lot better. But yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's true. Most couples, and it's generally the woman that's the oversharer. But not always.
Sometimes it's opposite. True.
Yeah. But there's usually somebody that is more verbal, mm-hmm. more outspoken, more emotional, and more dominant verbally, and the other one is not. So that's, it gets to the heart of marriage, which is basically to know each other and to be known. I just mm-hmm. love that. And again, this takes effort on both parts because, let's look at you guys. So, Derek, like me, is just not one that shares his heart naturally. So it takes you to ratchet back your overshare, overdrive, and just be a safe place to probe more and try to draw him out.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes effort on both parts, that's why I say an overshare and undershare, because the overshare has to work at this too. It's kind of like dial it back.
Oh, so, totally. You can't. Place. Yeah, you can't expect people to just open up their hearts. Like, I'm very overwhelming. So I got to pull it back a little bit in order for Derek to be like, oh, okay, I can step in the premises. Okay, great. So, yeah, you're right. You're right.
When you take a breath, right? And the other thing is about this one is that, you know, also by sharing, like, men generally are problem solvers. And they usually
isn't
have
that
to, like,
the case?
Oh,
my
Lord.
They
really do. Like, just listen. So anyway, that's another aspect of sharing your heart.
True.
So the third one is a really, really big one. I call it learning from your conflict.
Mm.
And number one is, right, we all have conflict. I mean, just we're imperfect people. We don't handle things well. A lot of insecurities, defensiveness, self-focused, and all that.
Mm-hmm.
We have conflict. We're couples, and this is from Gottman. I mean, he does a great job in assessing and researching couples, and this is a big one. He's found that like 90% of times, couples that do well in marriage and succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it's learning from conflict. And what that means is after you have a little or big fight or conflict argument, not in the moment, that's really clear.
Yes.
Not in the moment,
mm-hmm.
but sometime, maybe even the next day when you both have had time to process things,
mm-hmm.
come back to the conflict, almost like dissect it. Like, what happened here? Like, what was the issue?
Yep.
Why did I react the way I did? To really learn. And then from that, like, how do we prevent this from happening again? This is a really powerful tool
mm-hmm.
if couples can learn this.
Yeah.
You know, we saw this in a young couple just 2 weeks ago where they went to see a movie and the guy loved it. I mean, it was a great, great movie. He loved it, loved it, loved it. For some reason, the woman, like, it triggered something.
Mm.
Triggered something.
Mm-hmm.
And she couldn't wait to get out of the movie theater fast enough.
Yeah.
And he was like, just, I want to talk about this. What a great movie. And she was, like, shutting down. And they had an argument. They came back to it the next day, like, what happened here? And then she explained how it hit and triggered something to her. So learning from conflict is a big one.
That's really true.
It's a good tool to have.
Yeah, it definitely is. I would say it's one of the best tools for sure.
It is. Yep. Takes effort. Mm-hmm. Takes effort. And also, you know, you got to, like, trust each other. Like, why did this trigger me?
Yeah.
You got to be pretty honest with yourself.
It's true.
You really do.
Mm-hmm. I love this last one, though, Bob, using humor, because I think we've capitalized on this. At least in our marriage, we have to use humor.
Yeah. You know, most people do. And so what I don't mean here is not to have – it's not predicated on having a sense of humor. This is really about getting over yourself – getting over your pride, having humility, and being playful, and look at how you can make marriage fun,
mm-hmm.
okay? It's not about telling jokes and picking on each other. That is not the case.
Right.
But, like, I'll give you a great example. Like, you know, Karen, like, a week ago, she has notoriously cold hands. And I was getting dressed. My shirt was off, and she came up behind me, and she put these ice-cubed hands on my back. They were freezing, right?
Yeah.
And I jumped and screamed. And she ran away laughing. And you know what my immediate reaction was? I said, I love being married to you.
Yeah, because she's fun.
You know, it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, finding ways to make fun of yourself, not each other, but yourself, is a nice trait to have.
I love that. Well, Bob, I know that if people ever want to get any tips and they want to talk to you about their marriages, their relationships, where can they go to reach you?
Yep. I mean, two ways. One would be just Twitter. Follow me on Twitter at MarriageCoachBD, or just shoot me an email, Bob, B Donovan, D-O-N-O-V-A-N, at blackrock.org.
Bob, I always love talking to you. Thank you so much. And we'll talk in a couple of weeks.
All right. Take care.
All right. You too.